Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Yaron Brooks Show, and I'm excited today. I get to interview Rajshri Agrawal, who is the professor of strategy and entrepreneurship at the University of Maryland. She's also the director of the Ed Snyder Center, and we should talk a little bit about Ed, Rajshri. I think this will be a good opportunity to talk a little bit about Ed. Again, at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. She's got a BA in economics, an MA economics from Bombay University in India, but also an MA economics and a PhD in economics from SUNY Buffalo. Rajshri, we just figured it out that we met in 1995 in Florida, in Orlando, in Tampa.
I was living in Orlando.
You were living in Orlando, and I was running Lyceum Conference, a weekend conference. I think we had Gary Hall and Andy Bernstein and maybe Richard Salzman speaking.
And that was my first Objectivism conference, by the way.
And I was running the conference in those days. And we've stayed in touch since then on and off over the years. When Rajshri was at University of Illinois, I came out and gave a talk out there, and we spent some time together. And now she's at Maryland, and now she's getting involved in the Objectivist conferences at OCON. She's been a speaker for a couple of years, and there's tons going on. The Ayn Rand Institute has worked closely with the Snyder Center for Enterprise. So hey, Rajshri, it's wonderful to have you on. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Yaron, for having me on your show. It's been a great friendship. I think
absolutely.
We're dating ourselves when we say 1995, aren't we?
I know. I keep thinking how old I'm getting.
I was a young assistant professor in economics at the University of Central Florida when you and I met.
That's right. And then we talked on the phone several times while I was in I was at Santa Clara University. And Rajshri did the smart thing for an economist. She went and taught in a business school, which basically raises your salary significantly and makes your work substantially more interesting.
Well, actually, the latter part, of course, the salary, who's going to complain about
exactly.
that? But really, what I found very interesting was that I thought that I would find in economics what I really found in a business school. And that is a sense of, you know, who are the innovators? Who are the entrepreneurs? How do they create new industries, not just new firms, and as a result contribute to economic growth and social prosperity?
Yeah, I mean, isn't it sad that economics, most of economics, not all economics, ignore the entrepreneur, ignore the business leader, they have a theory of the firm, but it's really an abstract theory, and they don't really get the micro, what's interesting, which is individual human behavior in the business that creates production.
That's right. In fact, one of the reasons why I was attracted to economics is, of course, because I was interested in studying innovation. But especially in the 1990s, when I got my PhD, it was very game theoretic and very mathematical, homogeneous behavior by all individuals. There's no heterogeneity, nothing interesting. Everything interesting was assumed out of the economic models. And even especially at that time, though it's less so now, the social planner who's omniscient and infallible and knows exactly everything, with hindsight of 2020, was exactly the model that you have to solve. So the innovator, the entrepreneur, the experimentation, the figuring out something new and creative was completely absent in most of the economics models. And it's interesting because, you know, Schumpeter and Ludwig von Mises and a lot of the Austrian economists very much talked about the innovation engine being the Schumpeterian entrepreneur. And I was attracted to that. That's why I came into economics. And it's good to see that it's now made a revival,
yep.
for sure in business schools, but definitely in economics.
Yeah, I think the Austrian school and Israel Kürzner, who is probably the most prominent modern Austrian who teaches at NYU and whose books have primarily focused on the entrepreneur, but there's real revival in studying entrepreneurship within economics. And I think that's primarily the influence of two things. One is the Austrian school, and the second is business, is the business schools. You know, I think economics was felt like, hey, everybody's leaving for business schools. We need to catch up. And it's about time. It really is about time. But yes,
but
when I studied economics, when I was getting my PhD in finance, and I had to take two economics classes, I took my first in microeconomics, and I walked into class, and day one, the professor put up an equation on the board, a long differential equation, and he said, we're going to spend the entire course deriving from that equation.
Uh-huh.
And I went, oh my God, this is not economics. And then I went to my advisor, and I said, I don't care what we have to do. I'm never taking an economics class again. I don't want to study any more economics. So somehow we got around that. But yeah, the way economics was taught, and I think this still is taught in many schools, is just terrific. It's just terrific.
I agree. In fact, my younger daughter, Alicia, is taking both microeconomics and macroeconomics. She just finished those two sequences. And, you know, when I was giving my distinguished scholar teacher talk last year, at the University of Maryland, she was in the audience. And so I was talking about my research, which was much more about entrepreneurship. And it is, you know, starting with Schumpeter's creative destruction premise that really takes to task the marginal analysis viewpoint in economics.
Yep.
So it was quite cute because there's Alicia learning about marginal benefit and marginal cost, which are great concepts, by the way, you know. I mean, opportunity cost, marginal cost, and benefits are very good ways of thinking through the decision that you're making, but that's not it. And that's not all.
No, and things like perfect competition and monopoly, all of that is just nonsense. Just a waste of time. I mean, maybe you need to spend half a class on it for kids to understand the models, but mostly it's just complete waste of time. Because
I won't quite say it's a waste of time.
I am still
a card-carrying economist, but I do think that what it taught me is good logical thinking. I think it talks a lot, you know, so sound economics background is a good starting point to take off from. But of course, you now need to think about much more. So, you know, economics makes certain assumptions about human behavior. And in that paradigm, it then creates models. We in the business school, at least I think I've benefited from that economics background. But of course, I bring a lot more of the psychology, the sociology, and of course, the businessman is your quintessential engineer to what economics is like physics would be.
So, I mean, the beauty of the Austrians is that they can do real economics without having to have these abstract models that don't ultimately relate to reality. Yeah, it's kind of, it teaches a certain level of logical thinking, but it's so easy to then go from that to the purposes, perfect competition. That's the goal, which is like,
completely agree.
You know,
I don't think there's anything perfect about perfect competition.
No, it's a disaster.
That term,
it's
perfect competition. Right. I mean, the only reason I find any value is show how, when those assumptions are violated in the real world, interesting things happen.
Yes. Yeah, so let me just, I forgot to say this, but I mean, one of the things that's amazing about Retri is that she is one of the most prominent business professors on the planet, certainly in the United States, probably the most one of the handful of prominent strategy academics in the world today, and has been recognized as such, and she's an objectivist, and it's cool. It's cool to have somebody as prominent as Retri is in her profession, and yet, so tell us, when did you read Ayn Rand for the first time, and kind of tell us a little bit about that objectivist journey, if you will.
Oh, so, well, I read Ayn Rand at a very, very critical point in my life, Yaron. As a girl growing up in a very traditional family, it was my brother that introduced me to Atlas Shrugged for the first time. The first time I heard about Ayn Rand was my brother comes home one day and he's pretty depressed. And of course, at this time, I'm still in high school. And then he turns around and says, you know, my favorite author passed away today. And I said, who's
that? Wow.
And so that was the first time that I heard about her. But fast forward about 4 or 5 years later, you know, here I am in this very traditional society, with gender norms being very prevalent, particularly in my family. And so I was going through a huge identity crisis. Who am I? What do I want to be? How do I fit in the norms that I do? And it's during that time that I truly discovered Acupuncture. And I must tell you, Yaron, it saved me. It saved me in so many different ways because it gave me the strength to stand up against the one person that was truly my idol, and that was my father.
Yep, yeah.
And it gave me a sense of, you know, I wasn't wrong in my individualistic thinking. I was very lonely growing up in a culture where, you know, the norm is what society going to think. How are we going to behave? How are we going to conform? And of course, as a woman, why don't I conform? Why do I have so many wives? I mean, my science teacher once asked me, Rashmi, why do you have so many wives? You know, and
yeah,
so
yeah.
It was in that culture about 30 years ago that I grew up. And for me, reading Atlas Shrugged literally just changed my life. I knew what I wanted to do, and it acted like a beacon for the United States.
So, yeah, so I had the same impact on me in terms of, certainly in terms of the beacon of the United States. I think the culture I grew up was probably less tradition bound, but still challenging in other ways. But the idea that I wanted to move to the U.S., that was solidified with Atlas Shrugged. I mean, it was a done deal.
So interesting to me, Iran, and I keep saying this. When in India, all of my college friends, they may not have agreed with Atlas Shrugged or Ayn Rand or Objectivism, but they were willing to argue and fight. They'd heard about it.
Yep.
I came here for the first year of my PhD. I was all ready to engage in these kind of conversations. And so I spoke to Beth, who was my friend. Immediately we bonded. And I said, yeah, my favorite author is Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand who? And I found so many students in the American universities had never heard of her. And that just blew me away.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was disappointed when I came to the U.S. I found the students be non-intellectual and a little dull. I mean, as compared to Israel or as compared to other places in the world. And, you know, I was disappointed immediately with the level of the other students in my MBA program where I was studying.
Yeah, yeah. But I had a lot of fun with my friends,
yeah.
You know, and I mean, for me, also take it in my context, right? For me, this was discovery.
Yeah.
This was adventure of the highest order. This was finding myself and learning to figure out whom I liked and whom I didn't. And so I was just in the process of getting to know people and bonding with them on the things that I could and did. And so, and then of course I always read, so
yep.
That was
yep.
Fine.
So let's talk a little bit about your research and what you write about. So, I mean, Rajshree writes a lot of op-eds in addition to dozens of academic papers. I mean, the list of academic papers just goes on and on and on and on. I'm very jealous, but, here's some examples of titles of op-eds, right? Here's why ethically you should stop bashing business. What was it? Independence of thought is vital to America. She's also pro-immigration, which is not surprising given our backgrounds. Immigrants to the U.S. create jobs. That's absolutely the case. And on and on. So not only does Rajshree do a lot of academic work, but she also writes some powerful and very good editorials. But tell us a little bit about the academic work you do in strategy and entrepreneurship.
Yes. So thank you, Iran, for asking me
sure.
That. Well, first off, I've really never changed the topic of my research, even though I have transitioned from economics to strategic management to entrepreneurship. And now I say I'm a scholar of human enterprise. Because at the core of all of this is evolution, it's growth. And that is what fundamentally is something that I'm excited about. So for me, one of the things that I discovered about myself all through this process is for me, the journey is the destination.
Yep.
And when I say the journey is the destination, I also care deeply about upward mobility. And when I talk about upward mobility, of course, I use the term very deliberately, because as an economist, upward mobility is immediately thought to be in the material realm. But for me, upward mobility is truly about an integration of psychological, intellectual, and economic growth. And so for me, I have always been a scholar of evolution, of growth. I started off looking at industries. How are they conceived from first commercialization all the way into maturity? But you know, Iran, one of the things that I realized, industries don't make decisions. And so I moved into strategic management because I was interested in decision making. Specialist firms make decisions.
Yep.
And so I moved into strategic management and I looked at what caused entrepreneurial firms to prosper and grow and what caused exit and failure of certain firms. And then it was like, duh, Rashri, firms don't make decisions, people make decisions, which is why I got engaged in entrepreneurship, and particularly employee entrepreneurs. These are the people that work for some of the best companies in their industry, gain a lot of industry-specific knowledge, but also want to venture out on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So I started off studying employee entrepreneurs, which across multiple industries are actually the fountainhead of all of the growth that occurs. And so that's when I realized that, well, to study employee entrepreneurs, I need to look at their capabilities. But beyond that, I also need to be looking at their aspirations, their values. And so all through, I have changed levels of analysis, moving from economies to industries, to firms, to individuals, and then even within individuals, what are their aspirations, what are their abilities, and how do we exist in an ecosystem?
Mm-hmm.
Together. So that's been basically my 25 years worth of study.
That's great. How would you say objectivism and Ayn Rand's ideas have affected that growth or that direction that you took?
So, you know, we were just talking about perfect competition,
yep.
For instance. And we often think in terms of markets or capitalism. I tend to use the term free markets rather than capitalism. To denote the same thing. So I'm going to use them interchangeably. Yep. But when we think about markets and we think about these economic models, we're always talking about competition. But you know, one of the fundamental things reading a lot of her nonfiction was this one point where she said, capitalism or markets is not about competition. It's about collaboration. It's about creating win-win trade. So if you were to ask me, both in my own personal life, and this relates to even my husband, Rob, who's the love of my life, and in terms of my work, I firmly believe in the concept of the trader principle. And so I think among many, many influences, if I were to say what is the one hallmark that especially as a business school professor is a takeaway for me, is that markets are first and foremost about collaboration. And indeed, those that create better win-win outcomes through working with other team members, working with suppliers, working with customers, right? The ones that are better able to create win-win outcomes win at the expense of people who aren't able to create as much value.
Yep.
But even their competition is a secondary consequence of superior collaboration.
And at the end, it's not at their expense because they didn't have any. It's not that something was taken exactly. And they benefit from living in a free market in which wealth is created and jobs are created, and then they have alternatives. So we have, so I'm committed to taking questions in the super chat, although I do want people to ask questions related to what we're talking about now. So this question is not exactly related, but it kind of fits into what you just said. So I'm going to take it anyway, and we can both answer it and see where we go from there. So this is Dr. Pai, or I don't know who this is. But anyway, he asks, how would you respond to Michael Shermer's critique of Ayn Rand's theory of human nature as wholly selfish and competitive, right? So hold that. He claims that Ayn Rand's theory of human nature is wholly selfish and competitive. And then he says, science shows we also harbor a great capacity for altruism, cooperation, and charity. So there's a lot of package here. So let me unpackage it a little bit, and then I'll go to Rutri. Certainly, Ayn Rand does not believe that people are automatically selfish and competitive. And selfish and competitive are not the same thing, and they don't overlap. As Rutri just said, being selfish is not about beating somebody else. It's not about competition. Being selfish is about your own human flourishing. And one of the primary ways in which you do that, use your own mind to create win-win relationships out there in the world, both spiritual relationships and material relationships in business. And then there's a lot of difference between altruism, cooperation, and charity. Altruism means living for other people. It means sacrificing yourself. It means living for the sake of the other at your own expense. It does not mean being nice to people. It does not mean win-win relationship. Cooperation is something completely different. Cooperation is completely consistent with selfishness, as is some charity. Charity can be selfish. It isn't always selfish, and often it's not selfish, but it can be. So if I don't think this is Michael Shermer's view because he's smarter than this, but if it is, then he both gets Ayn Rand's view wrong and he gets what science shows is wrong. He's getting it all gobbled. It probably is Michael Shermer's view after all. So let's talk a little bit more about this idea of competition versus cooperation and how it plays out in actual business. I mean, the example I always give is Apple competing with Samsung, or is Apple cooperating with Samsung, given that Samsung makes several of the items inside the iPhone? You know, and Samsung keeps copying from Apple. Is that cooperation? Is that competition? Is that common in business out there?
Right. So, again, going back to, so I'm gonna answer it two ways. I'm gonna answer it in the abstract, but then I'm also gonna use an example that is really personal to me. We talked a little bit about Ed Snyder Center for Enterprise and Markets, and let me actually take it from that aspect, and then I'll return back to cooperation and competition. So, Yaron, I was a nerd.
I'm shocked.
Really, right? I mean, look at the career that I'm in. So I was a badminton champion in college. So I did have that. But I was much more attracted to debate and to, elocution competitions and so on. Now, where am I going with this? When I was given the chance, so for me, heroes weren't the Hollywood, Bollywood heroes, nor were they sports stars. For me, heroes were always the innovators, the entrepreneurs. And one of my two heroes in real everyday life, one is John Allison, and the other is Ed Snyder. And I only use these two in one after the other because I met John Allison, thanks to you, by the way. Really appreciate that. And Ed Snyder immediately after. So both of them actually personify this concept that there is no tension between competition and cooperation. In fact, both of them end up being two of the most benevolent people that I have met. And I have met a lot of very nice people. But I'm using them both as very successful business people that actually became successful precisely because they focused on cooperation. But the cooperation was not just about, I need to work with you, and then how can I free ride off of you? So, often people end up thinking, well, if you're cooperating with somebody, then you really weren't independent by yourself. That is a false notion, and it comes into selfishness also. But for me, the point of cooperation is I'm going to do the best that I can. I'm going to be the best in class talent in my area. And then I want to look and seek others who are best in class talent that complement me. However, we're both aligned in our shared values, in our shared vision. And so when two people come together to cooperate, their focus is not about out-competing somebody else. Their focus is about creating value, being excellent. Now, when you focus on creating value and being the best person that you can be and learning and growing with each other, great things happen through that cooperation. Now, of course, it may be that through that cooperation, the value that you create implies that somebody else has not been able to create that same value. But as we were just saying before, that doesn't mean that that person's worse off. In fact, in business, the way to create value is very simple. Do it better, do it cheaper, or do it faster. All three of these are making somebody else better off through the creation of value. And even the people that are being outcompeted are learning and innovating through the person that is coming up with new ideas. And so through that process of innovation and then imitation, even the competitors become better off because they're being more efficient with the resources that they have.
Yeah, so absolutely. So the fact is that people who are very successful in business that I've known don't seem to be focused on the competition. They seem to be focused on being the best that they can be. And by being the best that they can beat the competition. Great. But their focus is not the beating. The focus is on the creating, the valuing, the making, the producing.
And what a positive sense of life, right? I don't want to be waking up in the morning thinking about whom am I going to beat? Whom am I going to get ahead of?
And it's so second-handed. That's so
exactly.
It means your life is being measured. Your success in life is being measured by somebody else, by somebody else's success or failure or abilities versus measuring it based on your own.
And that is exactly where I find that this false dichotomy between self versus others, you're pitting yourself, you're creating this win versus lose situation. I would rather be, and in fact, if you think about it, just everyone that's listening to it, just pause for a second and think about a day in your life. What fraction of your thoughts, your actions, your interactions relate to this negative sense that I got to beat somebody? And what fraction of the time do you spend working with people, whether it's at home? I mean, I'm a parent. I don't say that I do it all by myself. I need Rob to parent with me.
Sure.
At the Snyder Center, I have a very great team of staff, right? I have my managing director, Christina Elson. She and I are working together. So when I think about the time that I'm spending, it's mostly in collaboration. It's mostly working with other people that are also hand in hand, positively thinking about where is it that we can create value. And that's so much more fun. That makes me want to get up in the morning with a spring in my step. If I have to think about a negative conversation or a confrontation that I have to have, that actually brings me down. That's not selfish. I mean, I can do it if I have to, but I don't get joy out of it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. But, you know, competition can be fun, right? We certainly compete on the basketball court. Professional athletes compete. And I think businessmen do compete. But they compete not in the sense of wanting – a good businessman doesn't compete in the sense of wanting to destroy the other, but in a sense of being the best and striving to be the best. But his focus is on self. Even an athlete, I think, is trying to be the best that he can be. And the expression of that is by beating the other side in the basketball court. But that's just the expression of it. It's not the purpose is to be good.
Right, I agree. And in fact, in parties that I throw at my house, I make sure that we have a makeshift volleyball court. I'm not very good at playing volleyball, but I'm very competitive on the court, right? Because I want to do the best that I can, and it's a fun sport where we're having a lot of fun.
Yep. So do you find, you know, put aside, obviously, Ed Snyder and John Allison. Do you find this as a prevalent feature among entrepreneurs and among successful business people, or is this just the exceptions of the ones that have been exposed to Ayn Rand as both Ed and John have been?
Well, Ed has been, John has been, Carl Barney, whom I also met, is very much of an objectivist entrepreneur. I think most business people end up being torn. Very similar, I think, to Hank Reardon in Atashra. And my father was the perfect example of precisely this type of an entrepreneur, where it was almost as if we were to look at him and how he operated in business, it was very much this creating, excelling, doing the best that they could be. But then they were within a society where they had never really stopped to think about integration of what they did in the economic realm and what they needed to do to thrive psychologically and intellectually. And I often think that it is that lack of integration that unfortunately tears most entrepreneurs and business people asunder. I mean, it's very tragic if you think about it. And the reason why you mentioned one of my op-eds, where here's why ethically you should stop bashing business, it's because one of the things that I realized that as an intellectual, I had failed the future business leader in the classroom. Because even as I was teaching them concepts of strategic management and the economics concept of, you know, how do you build on your resources and your capabilities to be the best that you can be? How can you innovate and so on? I never really, I mean, I did, but most of us in the profession, in the academia, do not arm our future business leaders
yep.
with the right moral concepts. So that they don't get torn by this. I mean, think about our concept of ethics, by the way.
Yeah.
Right? When we teach ethics in business schools, it's all about compliance.
It's all about law. It has nothing to do with ethics.
But worse yet,
yeah.
right? If you think about the fact that there are a distribution of people, and you're going to, and all of your ethics is about how do you get the people at the lower end of the distribution, those that are unethical,
yeah.
those that are going to break laws, are going to be this brute concept of selfish rather than what we think about as win-win trade, right?
Yeah.
And if all of the ethics that we're giving them is about you need, everybody's a thief, and you need to create laws that are going to stop people from opportunity.
Yep.
Now you're not even talking about the true challenges, the true dilemmas that a person can face as it relates to this integration that we talked about. You know, what are my values? Am I living up to my truth's potential? Have I defined what my system of values are?
Yep.
So, you know, people often say to me, oh, you're a libertarian. And you know, I don't want to get into labels, but my point out here and the reason why I say that if I were to define myself, I would define myself as an objectivist is because being an objectivist is actually very hard. Happiness.
You mean being selfish is hard?
Very hard.
Yes, exactly.
Very hard. Because if you think about it, for me to turn around and say that I want to be happy, happy is not whim worship.
Yep.
Happiness is not about, oh, I want to get this ha-ha sense of getting drunk, having this. No, happiness is an earned sense. As Ayn Rand said very, very eloquently, it is the state of mind that comes from an achievement of one's values. But before you achieve them, you have to define what your values are. And that requires a lot of hard work.
Yeah, and achieving them requires a lot of hard work.
And requires, of course.
Particularly if they're ambitious values.
Of course. And so there are all kinds of minute decisions that you have to make throughout the process of doing so. I mean, I often say I feel younger today than I did 15, 20 years ago. And the reason I feel younger today is because I finally can say that I'm happy. I couldn't say I was happy even 10 years ago because I was still working towards that.
Yeah, no, that's great. And, you know, if my body wasn't falling apart, I'd agree with you. But some
yeah, whatever.
Ache and pain that reminds me that I'm not that young anymore.
Yeah.
But yes, I know exactly what you mean. Spiritually, absolutely. I mean, the more we know, the easier, in a sense, it becomes, right? The easier it becomes to define your values, the easier it becomes to work towards them, the less conflict there is. You know, she defined happiness as, you know, a uncontradictory state of uncontradictory joy. And getting rid of those contradictions, resolving those contradictions, is a lot of work because of the way we're raised and the way we grow up, particularly given the culture you came from.
Yes.
It just came with a lot of baggage.
And of course, it's easy to say shortcuts, right?
Yep.
So in fact, I often talk about the fact that I promised myself, Yaron, that I'd never, ever be the kind of a parent that said, do this because I told you so.
Yeah.
Right? Because I was always going to encourage that in my kids. But try telling your kid who is in the middle of a meltdown, right? Maybe sugar caused, maybe because of whatever reason, right? that you can't reason with them at that point in time. So right there is an example of a contradiction.
Yep.
That you have to say, but wait a minute, I want them to think on their own. But now I'm telling them, no, you will do this while I'm telling you what I'm telling you to do. And that also then requires that very simple level to figure out, yes, I'm not contradicting myself. When I'm saying in this moment, you are not capable, I'm not capable of reasoning with you. But I am your parent. I do have your best interests at heart. And at this point in time, you will do what I say.
Yep.
At a later point in time, we can go through and dissect and discuss why it is that the reasons, you know, I can give you my reasons, you can give your reasons, and you know what? You may very well be right. And as a parent, I don't have the ownership of always being right. One of the things that my kids do is they're constantly challenged.
Yep.
And I grow as a result of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's delve a little bit deeper into this idea, because it's so prevalent in business that, I mean, business is obviously self-interested. People are there to pursue profit, but also to pursue their own happiness, their own ambitions, their own passions, their own interests. But the perception of self-interest in the culture and in business ethics and in really everywhere is of Bernie Madoff, right?
Yes.
And what does that create? What kind of, you know, contradictions does that really create?
So the point out here is Bernie Madoff wasn't selfish.
Yes.
Right? In fact, as you were saying before, he was one of the most salient examples of a second-hander.
And a self-destructive
yes. second-hander. Because, yep. And this is exactly what we were saying earlier, that identifying what your values are and staying true to them requires a lot of hard work. It also requires you to be able to say, you know, there are all kinds of riches that might come my way if I take shortcuts. But are these riches truly making me intellectually, psychologically, if you will, spiritually rich? Or is it just a shortcut economic riches, right? I mean, one of the things I loved about Ed Snyder is he said, money is the reward, not the reason.
Yep.
Now, let's just take that sentence. Money is the reward, not the reason. It's not the reason, because what is driving you is this desire to create. But once you create it, money better be a reward, because that relates, you know, so once you've created a lot of value, so one of the things, going back to this concept of altruism or giving your money away, right? You don't get to be morally superior because you gave money away. You're actually morally superior because you created money in the first place.
Yep.
That is your first claim to values, because to truly create value, the way the Ed Snyders and the John Allisons of the world do, as opposed to the Bernie Madoff, right? You have to create value for everybody else in a long-term and consistent way. If you thieve it, it's going to come back and bite you sooner or later, because you didn't create the value that you tried to exploit. So for me, that is not the selfish person. The selfish person is the one that says, how do I create? How do I use my abilities and my aspirations to create the best value that I can for the passion? Being able to say, I love what I do and I'm good at it altogether. That for me is the essence of a selfish person.
Yep.
Right? But the opposite of it is that the selfish person is also constantly thinking of the dual. And that is, what is my value proposition?
Yep.
What are my features that create benefit to you in trade? And so then I can focus on those features, those abilities that I'm truly good at, and I love what I do, and they're creating value in the same thing. Now that is much, much more sustainable than the Bernie Madoffs of the world.
Yes, and it's sustainable economically, and it's sustainable spiritually, and it's sustainable as a human being. Bernie Madoff is in jail, and it's not an accident. And he was unhappy before he went to jail. He was not a human being. He's never lived as a human being. Really, his entire life has been a fraud and a fake. And I think that's the consequences of living that kind of life, because what he negated was really the way in which you make all these decisions, which is the use of your reason. You know, your reasoning mind. Bernie Madoff didn't reason. He emoted.
You know, and there's another aspect to it, too. When a truly selfish person recognizes that the principles of social interaction that you expect of the other person should also be what you grant the other person. So this is, again, going back to this trader principle.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the one concept across many, many that resonate with me. The trader principle, in essence, is saying that each and every one of us meet each other as independent equals. Not necessarily independent equals as in your ability in doing talk shows versus my ability in doing strategic management is equal. But the point out here is we're equal in the fact that we have the dignity of the right to our own life,
yep.
The right to make our decisions, right? And so if I expect you, Yaron, to respect my rights, I need to grant you the same dignity, the same respect. And that's where the trader principles mean that we're neither masters nor slaves, in her words. We're really coming together in something that is going to mutually be mutually beneficial by each and every, each of our independent judgments.
Yeah. No, absolutely. All right. Here's a question from that relates to employer-employee relations. This is from Adam. Should an employer fire an employee who sincerely says or writes things that result in other employees disliking working with him? I guess this could relate to that Google case, you know, Damore, who was fired because he wrote something that offended people and they didn't want to work with him anymore, and management decided to get rid of him. Do you have any opinion?
So, okay, so that... Again, there's so much to parse out,
yeah,
out there.
I mean,
but
it's
I
so contextual here.
Very,
yeah,
contextual. But let me use a principle that I often use. And that is this distinction between being nice and being kind. When we're saying that, you know, in an employee-employer
yeah,
relationship, going back to the trader principle, I need to give you the dignity of the fact that you have your opinion, your likes, your dislikes. I don't have to be 100% aligned with you in all of our beliefs to work with you. I only have to be aligned with you on the things that we agree to work on. And that's a very important distinction to make first and foremost, right? I don't have to be 100% aligned with you to work with you, but I do have to be aligned with you 100% on the things that we agree to work on. So first and foremost, you know, each and every one of us, going back to it, we have all kinds of opinions, thoughts, some of them well thought of, some of them not. The very nature of knowledge is that any one person is not going to be the omniscient, infallible expert on everything.
Yep.
So some of us have thought more deeply about some things and others haven't. Now, in the context of interactions in an employee-employer context, what I tend to focus on is, what is it that we owe each other? We don't owe each other niceness, by the way. Because niceness is, am I being nice to you means do you like me? As opposed to am I being kind to you? Which is really about giving you that dignity.
Such respect.
And in fact, niceness is going to cause me to be not honest with you. Whereas, because there the focus is, do you like me? And if anything that I say is going to cause you to not like me, then I'm not going to say that. And in doing so, maybe I'm not being very kind to you because I need to give you some honest feedback on things that you're doing that are impacting you either, you know, negatively at work.
Yep.
Now, I could be wrong and we can have a discussion on it. But here is where I think going back to that context of, you know, what should an employer do? Well, first and foremost, I would focus on, are those opinions relevant to the workplace, right? Are they causing discord in the workplace and impacting relationships?
Yep.
An employer does have a responsibility to make sure that everybody treats each other with dignity. And if that dignity is being violated, then I'm perfectly comfortable with saying, no, this person is creating an atmosphere which is not very conducive to being creative. Now, it's a lot more than, oh, this is the person that's at fault, right? You need to go into the details and really get to the true source of the conflict before you can choose that.
Yep.
So I don't know if I'm giving you a long, rambling answer to a contextual question, but the point at the end of it is, in every one of these situations, the focus needs to be who's creating value, how is it being created, and are we creating systems and processes where people can thrive with working this?
No, I think that's right. I think the key is to create a, in a sense, a corporate culture or a business culture, which is open and recognizes the fact that we're not all going to like each other. We're not all going to get along. There's a shared purpose, and we're evaluated based on that shared purpose. And if somebody is so disruptive that he is damaging our ability to move towards that shared purpose, then then you need to take action. Then you need to do something about it. But it's all in the context of that shared goal. So this brings up a good question. We talked about this a few days ago, I think. So there's a lot of this idea in objectivism. There's something about there's a conflict between self-interest and teamwork. That self-interest and the advocating for teamwork is somehow not objectivist, not right.
Here it's not the concept of self-interest versus teamwork or selfishness versus altruism, but about independence versus codependence. Or almost as if I am working in a team, then that means that I'm not independent.
Yes.
That I'm not using my...
Well, but to be self-interested means to be independent. One can't be, that's one of the five virtues, right? So in a sense, it is about not being independent, not being selfish. So if teamwork is perceived as contradictory because it's perceived as being, lack of independence, that somehow because I'm in a team, I'm not worthy or I'm giving up some independence. So is teamwork giving up independence?
Absolutely not. In fact, I'll tell you this. One of the things that really drives me crazy is in promotion and tenure committees, the conversation goes the following way. You're looking at a junior scholar that should, that is being evaluated for whether or not they should be promoted and tenured. The first and first question is, well, how many papers has this person written, solo authored? And then how many of these are co-authored? And if it's co-authored, then what fraction of the contribution is this person versus their team members? That kind of a conversation completely drives me crazy.
Yep.
For the following reason. If you have to move a sofa that is bulky from one room to another, you're physically incapable of moving it all by yourself. In two people moving a sofa from one room to another, it's a team production function to begin with.
Yep.
Because these two people are complementary to each other. Most academic papers, thank you for saying that I've got this long list
you do.
Of papers that you're envious of, but most of my papers, in fact, if I were to do it by myself, I would not reach the same kind of quality as I do while I'm working with my collaborators, many of whom are my students. But notice that I am not losing my independence, nor are my co-authors losing their independent thought in that process. We're both on specialization on what we're good at. And then there is the brainstorming. The process of creating new knowledge requires us to go into new areas, because if it is something that we already knew, then there's no research. There's no creation of it.
Yep.
The very fact that we're creating new knowledge requires us to kind of question our assumptions. And that's best done, at least for me, when I'm talking through these assumptions. And then we create this virtuous spiral where I'm saying something and then you disagree with it. And then I turn around and say, but what about this? And then we're questioning each other's assumptions and we're getting a so much deeper understanding of what's going on. That, for me, are the team complementarities coming to bloom. And I'm not losing my independence. In fact, I'm gaining more knowledge as a result of it.
Absolutely. I mean, again, it's a form of trade. It's a form of trade in which it's win-win, in which both are growing, in which, you know, both are getting better, everybody in the team. And you know, a team is only valuable if all of its members are independent, independently independent. Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And in fact, if they're not, then what value are they adding to the team?
Exactly. And then the consequence is it becomes a win-lose. That is, if somebody is not independent, they're just followers, then they're just a drag on everybody else. They're just a drag in terms of seeking truth or seeking improvement. They are dragging it backwards because they're a net cost without any real
any
profit,
added benefit.
Any added benefit. Absolutely. So how much of this, all of this stuff gets into the actual academic research that you do?
Oh, a lot. In fact, some of my most recent research is really about getting into entrepreneurial team formation. Because the truth of the matter is, and this is not necessarily the case that it's more true now than it was 100 years ago. In fact, you know, many of the research contexts, the industries that I studied, my dissertation went from 1887 to 1991. There were about 33 brand new industries that I studied. And since then, I must have studied at least 100, 150 more industries.
Yep.
Most recently, the cotton spinning industry.
Interesting.
In Japan, around the turn of the 19th to 20th century.
Yep. Yep.
Even then, as is now true, if you're truly taking on a big venture that you want to grow, one person cannot do all of the complementary capabilities that need to be done. It's very rare that you have a within-person integration of all the capabilities that you need. More often than not, it's going to reside in four or five different people, or two or three different. So this is where the concept of shared leadership is often misunderstood too. Because shared leadership means that, oh, neither of us is taking ownership of making decisions. I don't think that's the case. In fact, I think that in shared leadership, you need to own your opinions, your thoughts, your abilities that much more. And then you need to go ahead and figure out where is it that the corners need to be tested. So when you're truly trying to be complementary, each of you need to bring your A game on. And then make the other person even better.
Yep.
So in all of the business context that I see, so for instance, in the disk drive industry, that's another industry that I studied. I looked at all of the employee entrepreneurs, the spin-out, if you will. 25% of all entrants in the disk drive industry were spin-outs. And these were the ones that were the most successful in the industry. So we went back and we interviewed many of these successful entrepreneurs. And one of the things that we found out is that the complementary knowledge was actually a necessary condition. You needed to have a finance person, an engineer, operations person, all coming up to create a team. But that is not what distinguished the better spin-outs from the others. What distinguished the better spin-outs, interestingly enough, was the complementary knowledge, but two distinct things. One, each of them were matching with each other based on what is called by Gary Becker, assortative matching. Now, I'm using jargon words out here. Let me just kind of break it down. What that means is that you, Yaron, is the best-in-class talent to I, who's the best-in-class talent in what I'm doing. And we're going to seek each other, as opposed to you matching with somebody else that is lower than whom you can find. So, of course, everyone, the best matches with the best,
yep.
The second best matches with the second best, and so on. So you see those kind of complementarities in play. But most importantly, you find shared values. Those teams that were created because these individuals took time to recognize what were the values that they shared together. And they were willing to get their hands dirty in problem solving. Those were the teams that ran off with the biggest riches and became the movers and shakers.
So can
I
we
keep that consistent?
Sure. So can we take some examples from maybe companies that people would know? You know, is Apple a case of shared leadership?
So Apple would be a case, again, you have to look at the eras of it,
sure,
right? So for sure, Apple is where you have Steve Jobs as being the big iconic one. But as soon as he came back, the first thing he did was he hired Tim Cook.
Yep.
And if you look at the story of him hiring Tim Cook, it may very well have been that Apple was at the, you know, Steve Jobs was at the helm of Apple. But keep in mind that Apple could not have been continuously successful and as successful as it has been in the years since his passing if all we had at Apple was Steve Jobs and none of the other capabilities were in place.
And if you look at the at the distinction, Steve Jobs provide the vision and the imagination and the beauty of design, but without Tim Cook creating the supply chain and, you know, the supply chain, the global supply chain, the operations, and each one of them are best in class at what they do. There's nobody better at kind of the, on the imagination side, the vision side, the goal side than a Steve Jobs or the marketing side. And there's probably nobody better on the planet at supply chain management than Tim Cook. I mean, Tim Cook's real genius is in supply chain. And today, I think Tim Cook, because he probably lacks the vision, the design, the marketing, has to rely on the geniuses, other geniuses at Apple who supply that. Otherwise, he goes nowhere.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Good. So, you know, there were a lot of people here saying they didn't understand what we were talking about. So I think they understand now.
Did I become too academic?
You became too academic, and you need more examples.
Okay.
Concrete.
Fair enough.
Concrete for this audience. This audience is used to sound bites on Twitter and YouTube, right?
Well,
guys?
I'll try that. That's
you
why
can
I
try that.
So the next time you invite me on your show, I'll make sure I come armed with lots of contemporary.
Absolutely.
Examples.
No, that was good. He's saying, no, it's not. It's okay, he says. It's not you. He's just dumb.
No.
That's what he wrote.
I think, you know.
Got a little academic, but it was good stuff. It was good
fair
stuff.
Enough.
And
so here's what I say as a professor.
Yeah.
There's no dumb question except the one that didn't get asked.
That's right. And usually if it's a dumb question, it's the fault of the presenter who didn't present it clearly enough.
Exactly.
Not a knock against you, Rachu, but generally.
No, I completely.
They're no bad students. They're just bad teachers.
I say that about economics, by the way. When I taught economics, I had fun doing it.
Absolutely.
In fact, talk about examples. I talked about the concept of indifference curve.
Yeah.
With babies on the x-axis and boats on the y-axis. Talking about opportunity cost between
that's
babies
cool.
and boats. Because that's exactly what I had to deal with my husband. I had promised him a boat, and I gave him a baby instead.
That's
very
cool to the babies.
Money, about 25 years to deliver on a boat, and I finally gave him the boat.
You got him a boat. That's good.
I got him a boat.
That's good.
To talk about examples that really make it real.
So are there any examples that you can think of where it truly is a one-man show? Where really in Rand's The Fontanette, I mean, it really is, you know, hard work. Reardon. And it really is a one-man show. But can you think in business, given the size and complexity of these companies, where it really is a one-man show? I don't have a good example.
I don't know that I think in terms of one-man show versus not. Because if you're, you know, think about it this way. As a one-man show, you're going to sooner or later, what is our biggest and most valuable resource?
It's our minds. It's our
capacity
to reason.
Our minds and our time.
Yeah.
Correct? And there's only 24 hours in a day.
Yep.
Right? And so one man show means that sooner or later, you're going to run out of time.
Yep.
Because, I mean, I always say that my eyes are bigger than my mouth, which is bigger than my stomach.
Yep.
Because at any point in time, there are 10,000 things I want to do.
Yep.
So I don't think in terms of, again, this goes back to this false dichotomy that we need to have this glory of a one-man show because that's the lonely genius. That's the one that's winning against all odds. Yeah, but think about how much more the genius can accomplish if they now have 10 other geniuses with them.
Yep.
So I don't think, you know, so to truly grow a business, it cannot be a one-man.
Yeah, and to truly grow a business, I think somebody mentions Jack Welch as kind of a one-man show. But Jack Welch, the genius of Jack Welch, is one of his geniuses, because he was truly one of the great business leaders of the 20th century. But the genius of him was hiring great CEOs, because if you know GE structure, GE is a conglomerate.
One of the most diversified.
Yeah, incredibly diversified. It doesn't make any sense from a finance perspective, right? And you've got all these leaders of all these verticals. If you don't have exceptional people leading every single one of them, you as the CEO, you as Jack Welch, forget it. There's no way you can run GE. And part of his great talent was to hire.
You define who are the people.
Exactly.
So here's the other thing that I will say that people often don't think a lot about. So, you know, we often talk about how people are coming together and creating complementary knowledge, right? So you're the best finance professor that I know. I'm the best strategy / entrepreneurship professor that we know. The two of us can come together.
Start a business, Chatri.
So yep. That's one way of looking at it, right? The other way to say is, how did you and I select each other in the first place?
Yep.
I don't think we pay enough attention to the genius of selection to begin with.
Yep.
And so many of the people that are one-man shows, if you will, are ones that know completely well what they do very, very well. And what they don't do well, they figure out who else can do it.
Absolutely.
So that they're not wasting their time doing it. So again, it comes back to this issue of our infatuation with the concept of one-man show. Goes back to this dichotomy, which is false. It's that if you're not independent and doing it all by yourself, then you're not necessarily achieving anything that is worthwhile.
Yep.
And so I think I shared this with you. You know, recently I've been having, you know, remember my brother, who I said was the one that introduced me to Ayn Rand. So he very recently, especially because we've been talking a lot about my journey, sent me the saying, alone by herself, she built the kingdom that she wanted. And that got me thinking. And I said, you know, I do agree that I've built my own life, but it hasn't been alone, either in the building or in the living.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of these ideas that people have about what it means to be selfish, what it means to be independent. I mean, even somebody like Newton, right? So one of the great geniuses who clearly did it alone. I mean, in science, I think there's less, but he had to have Galileo before him. He had to have Copernicus. He had to have Aristotle way before him, right? So he was building, in a sense, on the shoulder on other people's genius. And even though he spent the time thinking by himself, which we all have to do, right? The thinking cannot be done together. We can help each other think, but it's still just like we can't eat for each other. We can't breathe for each other. We can't think for each other, but we can help each other eat. I mean, I benefit from the fact that there's a grocery store and they help me eat, right? I don't have to grow the stuff. You can help me think by recommending a good book to me, by challenging me, by asking the right questions, by telling me I'm talking nonsense when I'm talking nonsense. Those are the things that help me be a better thinker and thinking better. So, yes, there's this dichotomy is a false dichotomy that people have about objectivism and about selfishness and independence.
And take it one step further, right? Most people use it as one of two extremes. So either it is that I have to do all of my thinking all the way from the creation of the wheel or now, and only then can I claim any credit for any original thinking. So the opposite is when you say, oh, well, but if Newton was building on Galileo, then Newton can't claim any independence. No. Each and every one of us are, first of all, to your point, just because the knowledge is out there doesn't mean that it's in my head.
Yes, absolutely.
It has to be processed by me for it to be in my head. So this notion that as soon as something is discovered, It is completely and transparently and immediately, this is one of the assumptions in economics that we talk about, that is constantly flouted, right? Perfect knowledge. But just because somebody discovered it doesn't mean that everybody else knows it. We each have to go through the process of finding that knowledge and integrating it for ourselves. And after we do that, then comes that spark of what is I am over and beyond that. That now becomes knowledge for somebody else to gain because I created it.
And the fact is we don't need all the knowledge. I mean, that's the other thing, right? I don't know how to do agriculture. I don't know how to build an iPhone. And I don't need to. And the beauty of a division of labor society, the beauty of a win-win trading society is specialization. We can all specialize in the knowledge. But whatever knowledge we have to make it our own. And that's work. And that goes back to being self-interested is hard work. Having knowledge is hard work. What actually has to engage in work to make it happen. Well, this has been great. Thanks, Rajshri. I know it's past your bedtime.
I know.
It's over an hour already.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. And I'm sorry I won't see you at OCON, but I'm sure I'll see you.
We'll see each other in August in another conference.
That's right. We're both going to Steamboat Springs.
Steamboat
Springs Institute Conference in, I think it's August 10th,
10th 11th,
something like that. August 10th, 11th in beautiful Steamboat Springs, Colorado. So any of you who live in Colorado, join us at the Steamboat Springs Institute Conference. It's going to be a blast. There's going to be a lot of Republicans there, and they're going to be a lot of Trump supporters, which is going to make it particularly interesting for me to be there.
I'll be talking about academic freedom.
Yeah, which is great. That's a great topic. I think I'm going to be talking about why I hate Trump, but we'll see. And then I'm going to be lynched. You're going to be witness my lynching in Steamboat Springs, but we'll see. I think I'm talking about one talk about Atlas Shrugged, and then another talk about the state of America.
I look forward to that, Yaron.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. And for those of you online, don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel, to support me on Patreon so I can continue doing these interviews. We're going to try to do at least one a week with objectivist intellectuals and other intellectuals. Also, Rajshri, is there any website you want people to go to? Oh, you know what? I can't believe I forgot this. We need to say something about Ed Snyder. Because I think it's important just to give everything context. So those of you who don't know, I think many of you don't know this. Ed Snyder actually knew Ayn Rand and met Ayn Rand. Ed Snyder was one of the, I think, early investors and founders of
Ayn Rand Institute and Comcast.
Comcast. But he knew Ayn Rand in the 1970s. And when Ayn Rand died, he was the guy who really said, we need an institute. We need to continue to promote our ideas. We need to organize. And he really dragged, kicking and screaming, the intellectuals into basically a conference room and sat them down and said, we need to start an institute. So really, Ed Snyder was the founder of the Ayn Rand Institute. I mean, Leonard Peikoff was the intellectual energy behind it, but Ed was the business energy. And Leonard would have never started the Ayn Rand Institute without Ed Snyder. Ed Snyder brought the energy and the businessman attitude to it, and had a fantastic business career. Owned the the family still owns the Philadelphia Flyers, and for a while
they owned the Sixers
even, right, for a while.
They did for a while, yeah. And now Comcast is wholly owning.
Yeah. So Ed Snyder, a great businessman, a great friend of the Institute, a founder of the Institute, and the family now is great friends of the Institute. Of course, they founded the Snyder Center at the University of Maryland, really for Rajshri, because they identified Rajshri as a professor they wanted to support, and her as a voice to promote the ideas that I think Ed Snyder and many of us believe in the field of business. So
it was magic the minute I met Ed in his office.
He was a character.
I was told walking into his office that if the conversation wasn't going well, that I would know within 10 or 15 minutes because he would just get up and say he was done.
Yep.
So if the conversation lasted for a half hour, I was told that
you were
considered very
doing
successful.
Really well, yes.
An hour and a half later, he had already canceled two meetings.
Wow.
And then he said, I really, really have to go to this other meeting. But that conversation was a highlight of my life, no question about it. And for the next 2 years, he was such a source of inspiration. And true, you know, and just to meet someone that had actually been friends with Ayn Rand.
Yes, yes.
And figuring out what that was like, that was just amazing.
Yeah, and he passed away, unfortunately, 2 years ago. It's about 2 years now.
Two years ago. Still miss him.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. All right. Thanks, Rotri. I'll let you go to bed.
Thank you, Ron. Okay.
Thanks.
Take care.
Thanks,
good
everybody
night.
Else. And have a great night. And talk to you soon.
Bye.